this morning in a broad, general way about the main differences between the Oriental, which carries largely the matriarchal themes, and the Occidental, which carries largely the patriarchal themes, the Oriental and the Occidental traditions. In my view, the division between East and West should be drawn at in a vertical line through Persia, through Iran. Eastward of Iran, there are two great creative culture centers. One is northern India, and the other is China and the Far East. Westward of that watershed, there are again two great creative centers in the traditions of the high cultures. One is the Levant, or the Near East, which includes in this concept Egypt, and the other is Europe. Now, when you consider the two Oriental centers, you recognize immediately, look at this, that they are isolated. North of the Indian zone are the great Himalayas, and southward and around it are the oceans. So that in the early periods, new influences coming in would have to be very slight in their impact and could easily be assimilated to whatever culture form happened to be there before. Likewise, when you consider China, the great deserts to the west of China have, although new influences have come in, have made them comparatively slight, so that again in China we have this phenomenon of the absorption of new influences. This is conduced to a conservatism in these two worlds that is utterly amazing. In contrast to that, when you think of the two Occidental domains, the Levant and Europe, they are in close proximity. Furthermore, there's the Mediterranean, this wonderful waterway over which commerce has gone. Think also of the nature of Europe. In the north, there are the Baltic peoples. In the south, the Mediterranean people. The Asian world presses in. And the communications back and forth have been continuous and extremely disruptive. And wherever you have disruption, you're going to have new creation. There has been a movement here. Likewise, there have come in the raiding peoples, the northern Aryan herding peoples. And from the Syro-Arabian desert zone, the great Semitic invasions, again, a herding, raiding, warrior people. So that you have collisions here, back and forth, and many new influences coming in, not only of peoples, but also of culture elements. The Iron Age commences in the Near East and Europe almost 1,000 years earlier than in these other domains. Now, there are certain inevitable cultural and warrior qualities that come from use of iron, which is available in abundance, that can't possibly appear in a world where the weaponry is of bronze, which requires copper and tin being a very rare element, and all of this. There are great changes. Now, let us look at the East first, and this conservatism. What is it that is conserved? We have to ask, when do the high culture forms first appear in India and the Far East? They appear in the early Bronze Age. The early date for the arrival of high culture forms in India is about 2500 BC, 2500 BC. For their arrival in China, it is about 1500 BC. The first Chinese dynasty that is documented historically and archaeologically is the Shang, which is now being dated 1523 BC. 1523 to 1027 BC is the Shang period. As I pointed out yesterday, the origins of the Neolithic and Bronze Age cultures are in the Near East, in the Levantine area, and they are brought in to these more eastward domains and become established there as the basic culture forms of the high cultures 4,000 years later than in the Near East. Meanwhile, the Near East has moved on to something else. Now, with respect to that first of the mythological functions, the metaphysical dimension, how is it interpreted in the old Bronze Age world? How is it interpreted in the later Iron Age world of the West? I spoke yesterday briefly of the discovery, the recognition by the priestly observers of the skies in Mesopotamia, the observation that the planets move in a mathematically determinable motion and pace through the zodiac signs, the fixed stars of the heavens. And this recognition of a mathematically determinable inevitability and process brought about the idea of an impersonal force. Now, this is the fundamental thing in the whole of the Orient to this day, an impersonal force underlying the whole phenomenology of the universe. It is noted that this impersonal force carries us through a day of a certain length, light and darkness. This is the solar cycle. A month of a certain length of lunar light and darkness, which is again mathematically predictable. A year of a certain length of light and darkness. And this led to the intuition of a still larger cycle, which we call the eon, of the cosmic coming into being and going out of being. According to this view, there was never a beginning. There is a beginning only of each cycle, which then dissolves into abyssal waters, and out of which then there comes the next cycle, just as day comes after day after day. This cycling, this cyclic concept of time had no beginning and will have no end. There was no creator. There is no creator God. Furthermore, there is no God in our sense of an ultimate personage. Now, human beings, in order to think, have to think in terms of certain categories. And one of the most popular categories is anthropomorphic personification. So that people normally think of a god, of a presence, and we do have hundreds of images of Indian gods. But these gods do not stand as a final term in the way that Yahweh stands as a final term. They are simply accommodations to human thought which point past themselves to an utterly transcendent, unnameable, undefinable, inconceivable mystic mystery. That's the ultimate point in these Oriental traditions, as it was also in the Mesopotamian. This terrific, impersonal, you can't pray to the sun to stop. It won't. You can't pray to the cosmic order to change. It won't. There is consequently an attitude of absolute acquiescence in what is taking place. And the aim of the religious disciplines is to make the individual acquiesce. Now, with respect to the nature of this ultimate, there is no nature to it. It is beyond description, beyond names, beyond all categories. And when you realize that the categories of being and not being are categories, you realize that you can't say it either is or is not. When you realize that the terms many and one are categories, it neither is one nor is it many, you just can't talk about it. Now, to ask as we do, is the divine power loving, wrathful, pleased with me, preferring this group to that group. This, from this standpoint, is anthropomorphization of a mystery that transcends human concepts. This isn't loving, it isn't wrathful, it isn't any of this. And so what we're doing, from the Orient standpoint, in projecting these questions and relating ourselves to them, is simply anthropomorphically misinterpreting, and by that short-circuiting, the whole mystery. It is therefore absolutely transcendent of definitions. Now this word transcendent in theological discourse has two quite different senses. When we speak of God as being transcendent, we mean that that personage, which we name God, is outside of the universe. It transcends the universe. It's a kind of spatial transcendence. Whereas, as I'm using it, and as it refers to Oriental thinking, what is meant is all categories are transcended, even that of being outside or inside. Now the next point is that that mystery which transcends all conceptualization is the mystery of our own being. We are part and parcel of the universe itself, and the mystery of the universe is the mystery of ourselves. So that while it is transcendent, it is also, in a very deep and fundamental sense, immanent. That which is transcendent, in the sense in which I'm speaking, is also immanent in the same sense. And so we come to that key formula from the Chandogya Upanishad of about the 7th or 8th centuries BC, Tat Tvam Asi, you are it. That mystery which you seek to know, which you look for outside, which you project into personifications, such as Yahweh, is your own very being. And looking for it out there, you are losing it, because you are committing yourself to a notion of relationship, of dualities, of entities, which absolutely obscures the mystery. The fundamental aim, therefore, of all of the Oriental aspects of culture, insofar as they are traditional, whether it is philosophy, art, sociology, law, anything, is to bring you to an actual realization in experience of your identity with that mystery. And I call this mythic identification. The aim of all these systems is to bring about not simply the concept, which I'm sure we're all able to grasp, but the experience, which is something quite different again, as the root of one's life, of identity with that which is no that. This is what's meant by the fundamental Buddhist concept, Anatman. There is no self. That thing which you are protecting as yourself is no thing. So if we were to be rendering this algebraically in algebraic terms, we could write A equals X. A, you or anything else at all, are exactly that mystery. However, not the you that you think of as you. Not that entity born in time with a certain complexion, with a certain set of friends, with a certain identity, as we're saying now, peculiar to itself. That is not X. And so we come to this curious oxymoron, this curious absurdity, this curious self-contradictory statement. A does equal X. The A that you think yourself to be is not it. A Sanskrit term on this is neti, neti, N-E-T-I. Not it Na means not, iti means it, na iti, neti. I'm not my body. I know my body, I'm the knower of the body, I'm pure consciousness. I'm not my thoughts, my feelings. You can drive yourself out the back of the wall this way. You are not anything of yourself that you think of as yourself. And that which transcends all this thinking is exactly the you that is the basic you, which is identical with all things, and yet the concept identical can't rest with that. Now when you compare this with our Occidental forms, we come to a very interesting contrast. The religions of the West, as they now stand, are all derived from the Levant. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are sister religions. They are all rooted in the thought that has come to us through the Old Testament. The Old Testament is grounded in earlier Levantine traditions, most importantly, the Sumero-Babylonian complex. In these, the idea of distinction between man and God is fundamental. God is the creator, man and the world are the created, and creator and creature are not identical. In fact, what one finds when one reviews the Western religious traditions is that the realization or belief, I am that, is the prime heresy. It is for that that people are crucified and burned. When Christ said, I and the Father are one, that was blasphemy, and according to the text as we receive them, it was for that that he was condemned to crucifixion. 900 years later, the great Sufi mystic Halaj said exactly the same thing and received exactly the same punishment. He too was crucified. Just as a kind of interlude, let me say a word about Halaj's crucifixion. Halaj was a true Muslim, Sufi, and at the same time had reverence for the Quran and the results of Quranic thinking. He gave a little story to illustrate his situation. A moth sees a flame. A moth falls in love with the flame. The moth flies to the flame, flaps around it, singes its wings, and goes back to its friends and says, I found the most marvelous thing last night, and tells them all about it. What it wants is to be one with that flame. That is its principal aim. And so the next night, it does indeed fly into the flame, catch fire, burn, and become one with the flame. That's its aim, to extinguish its body. Halaj intentionally made the statement clear that I and my beloved are one, and the Orthodox tradition extinguished him. And so the function of orthodoxy for the mystic is to kill him. That is its virtue, for that he thanks it. One can ask oneself quietly whether that might not have been the aim of Christ himself. I mean, Halaj throws a light back on the mystery of Christ's activities that is certainly worth considering very seriously and not simply rejecting. The world, in its brutal character, in its self-confident character, in its worship of certain categories which it cares for, is in the service of the destruction of the mystic, you might say, and that is its divine function. This is the way Halaj would put it. Well, now, let us consider this. Since creator and creature are not the same, and since the experience of identity is the prime heresy, in the religions derived from the Levant, all that can be done in this context of quest is to render and experience a relationship to the divine. So that in algebraic terms, one would write ARX. A is related to X. How do we become related to the X in these traditions? Now remember, it was in the Levant that the earliest great high civilization forms developed. Very important in these was the society. The way we become related to God is through participation in and identification with His holy society. In every one of these cases, the peculiar local society regards itself as in a very special way divinely endowed. The God, since He is personified, who is the creator of the world, has also committed a certain group of people to His service, and this distinguishes them from every other group, and no other group is in relationship to the divine. This underlies every one of these traditions. Let's consider Judaism as the beginning, and we can go on down the line. God has a covenant with a certain people. No other people participates in this. How does one participate in the covenant? By being born a member of that group, born of a Jewish mother, to put it right on the ground, and then participating in the covenant, honoring it, observing its laws. And these laws were delivered specifically to a certain man in a certain place at a certain time, and no one else has them. In the Christian tradition, Christ is true God and true man. This Christians regard as a mystery. In the Orient, as I've shown, everybody can say this of himself. The aim is to be able to say that of yourself, or I can say it of any of these bits of paraphernalia in the room here. This is it. That divine mystery which lives in all things is the base of this chair that I'm looking at. You can take anything, a stick, a stone, a dog, a cat, draw a ring around it, put it there, cut it off from all your knowledges of relationship. What is it? Anything can become the focal point of a meditation on the mystery dimension. The whole universe is a revelation, thus, not of God, but of that divine mystery which transcends conceptualization as God. And it's everywhere in all things. In these other traditions, on the other hand, we have a special revelation, not a universal revelation. The universe reveals to those who know this God the marvels of that God's works. It's a totally different kind of universal revelation. When we speak of God being everywhere, this is not the same as saying that God is all things. In the Christian tradition, one speaks of man being made in the image of God. In the Oriental tradition, you are a manifestation of the very energy of God, and that energy is you, not God. God Himself is a manifestation of that. Christ is true God and true man. Through our humanity, we are related to Christ. Through His Godhood, He relates us to God. But how do we get related to Christ? Through membership in His church. The unbaptized are out. In Islam, it is the Quran as the word, the ultimate word of God. Now in Islam, the prophecies of the Hebrews and Christians are recognized, but they are, as it were, precursors of the ultimate terminal prophecy, which is of Muhammad. This is a totally different affair from the Oriental. Now, when you have two terms like this, God and man, you confront an ultimate decision. Where is your ultimate loyalty? To God or to man? the characteristic point of view of the Levant is ultimate loyalty to God. And this is primarily illustrated in the mystery book of Job. This is the, I would say, the deepest chapter of the Old Testament. God behaved outrageously in relation to Job, judged in human terms. You remember the bet with the devil. God was saying to the devil, "Have you considered Job? What a wonderful man he is." He was himself quite pleased that Job was pleased with God. And the devil was a wiser one. And he said, "Well, you just give him a few troubles. You've been treating him pretty fine, and see what happens there." So God said, "I'll bet you." The devil said, "I'll bet you." And God said, "Go to work." So you know where it ended. I just come from Hawaii, where they make necklaces out of little beads called Job's Tears. The story of Job is an enigma. His friends came and, in good Orthodox tradition, said, "Well, you've been a bad boy. That's why you're getting this. That's the old story." Job said, "No, I haven't." And he was exactly right. It was because he had been good that he was getting it, which is a strange thing. And in his virtue and in his knowledge of his virtue, he challenged God. God comes. Now did God say, "Look, Job, I had this bet, and you've been great. I won." No, he didn't do that. Did he say, "Look here now," and then did he try some circumlocution, some way of, you know, making believe that this thing made sense? Nothing of the kind. All he said was, "Are you big? Could you fill Leviathan's nose with harpoons? I did. You try it, you little worm. Who are you with your small range of mentality to question me?" Well, this fits the Oriental view. What is man that he should, in his conceptualizations, try to interpret the mysteries of being? But the Bible doesn't go with the Orient and say, "You are exactly what I pretend to be, namely the divine." Not at all. And poor Job, he said, "My ears have heard of thee, now my eyes behold thee. I'm ashamed that I judged." So in this dualistic relationship of man against God or God against man, Job renounces the humanistic judgment and does not condemn God, but gives him praise and worship. No Greek would do that. No Greek ever did that. Consider Prometheus, pinned to a rock by a big boy, Zeus to wit, who could easily have filled Leviathan's nose with harpoons. And just as outrageously, this punishment. And then the great Aeschylean representation of this, a little delegation comes, Prometheus, and says, "Apologize. He'll let you go." And Prometheus's humanistic answer, he did not abdicate his human judgment. He says, "You tell him I despise him. Let him do as he likes." Now, we can say, of course, Prometheus was himself a sort of transcendent being and not a mere human being. But the main point is that he did not abdicate the human judgment system. He stood on that. Also, we know how in the Hellenistic period and thereafter, the Greek deities lost stature. And in Aeschylus, the concept of Zeus becomes totally transformed into something much more in the Oriental style. Zeus is air, Zeus is earth, Zeus is the worlds between, Zeus is all things. This is the Brahman idea, the idea of the divine presence in all things. So that in the Greek mystery cults, you have a move completely in the direction of the Oriental discovery and recognition of transcendence. And you can read this in, Apuleius' Golden Ass, where at the end of his ordeal, the hero is worshipped as a god, and all a god is a recognized manifestation of this mystery. So we have in this Western world these two poles, the Orient, the Levantine acquiescence in the theological mystery and the humanistic maintenance of the human stand against it. The Greek hubris, this means don't challenge him. Doesn't mean honor. You don't challenge a sleeping dog, but you don't get down and worship it just because he could bite you to death. You are prudent in relation to the divine, you might say, as understood in these terms. Now, let me speak of a certain myth that is shared by all three traditions. You may not recognize it in my first designation of its character in relation to the Indian tradition. In the first of the Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, there is this wonderful story of the origins of being. It starts with the self, which is no self, at a time which was no time. But this being who was no being at a time that was no time said in a language that was no language, I am Ahang. Ahang is the Sanskrit for I. Of course he had to speak Sanskrit because just as Yahweh spoke Hebrew, these two sacred languages are antecedent to the universe. It is out of these words, of these languages, that the universe comes into being. People say that Yahweh created the world out of nothing. This is not true. He created the world out of words. He said, let there be light, bing, and there was light. And one reason why my Jewish students, every time I sneeze, say bless instead of God bless you is that by pronouncing the name of God, you are bringing God into the place. That's why the holy name must not be pronounced. When you pronounce it, he's there. And who are you to do that? You could blow up. This Sanskrit has the same virtues. The Sanskrit language and the Sanskrit roots are antecedent to the appearance of a universe. Logically antecedent, I'd say, since the universe had no beginning, you can't put it there in time, but it is logically antecedent to the universe. So this self who is no self said, Ahang. And immediately he was aware of himself as a self. That's the beginning of limited consciousness. With the concept I, Ahang, all mistakes, all illusions, all confusions begin. Well, his first thought, as soon as he had said I, was to preserve this I. And he thought, I'm in danger of death. Someone is going to kill me. And then the thought came to him, well, since I'm the only thing there is, what is there around to kill me? That was a fine logical conclusion. But then immediately he was filled with the desire that there should be another thing around. Oh, let there be something else. So fear is the first reaction to being something, and desire for something is the next. Fear and desire were the immediate consequences of the experience of I. Well, you know what desire does? It brings about what is desired. Out of oneself it comes. He swelled, split in half, and there she was. Then he, as the text says, united with her, and she thought, how can he unite with me since we are of the same substance? And she turned herself into a cow. He turned himself into a bull. That was the answer to that. She turned herself into a Jenny ass. He turned himself into a jackass. And that was the answer to that. And so they reproduced all beings down to the end. And when, after this had been accomplished, he looked around, he thought and said, all this am I. And the fact is that all these beings were identical, identically his substance, and he was all beings. Now let's move a few yards further, a few inches further west on our map, and we come to Israel and chapter 2 of Genesis. There is a young man, very young indeed, with all the desires of man, and he's pretty unhappy and lonesome in that garden that had been prepared. God brings him all the animals and he names them all, and God's looking to see what would be a proper companion for this lonesome Willie. And finally God has the brilliant idea of putting him to sleep and bringing forth the rib, as Joyce says, the cutlet-sized consort. There she stands. And here we are. The point here is that it was not God who himself split in half into two beings and reproduced the world, but an entity, God's creature, that was split in half. And so this whole duality of our existence and experience has no reference to God. Whereas in the Oriental system, it has indeed a reference to the divine mystery, because we too, who have come from the moon, and the moon always lets us know this, even today, the mystery is that we too, who seem to be separate, are one, and that is the basic of the whole sexual mystic tradition in the East. Through losing yourself in sexual union, you have recovered the experience, or an inkling of the experience of your identity, not only with that one who is opposite, but with all opposites. Now let's move just a little bit further west, and we come to Plato's Symposium and Aristophanes' wonderful myth of the beginnings of things. Now, of course, in that wonderful Greek world, the whole sexual relationship was one degree more complicated than it was in the primitive times, or maybe not. At any rate, there was respect for the homosexual relationship. And so we have three kinds of human beings in the beginning, in Aristophanes' little legend. Three kinds of human being, all twice as big as human beings are today. There were those that lived on the moon and were made of man and woman in union. There were those that lived on the sun and were made of two males in union. There were those who lived on the earth and consisted of two women in union. What now are two women? But these were one being. And they're beautifully described. They had, of course, four legs and four arms and two heads in opposite directions and so forth. And when they wanted to move, all they did was kind of go along like spinning wheels with all these wonderful arms and legs, and they were tremendously powerful, and they had the idea of storming heaven and all. And Zeus and Apollo became nervous about them and decided to cut them in half and reduce their powers by half. And so they performed these surgical operations, and Plato, or Aristophanes, describes them rather amusingly. When the two have been cut, of course, there's a big gash there, so they pulled it together and tied it together, and that's the navel. And then they turned the head around so that it was facing where the cut had been, and so forth and so on. And no sooner were the couples separated and surgically repaired in this way than all they did was sit down and embrace each other and just sit there absolutely immobilized. The one ultimate thing we all want is that situation. So the deity said, well, no work's going to get done this way, and these poor creatures are going to starve to death. So they separated the matched couples, and in quest for each other, a lot of work got done, and that is what we call civilization. And this is Sigmund Freud's theory as well, that everything that's done that isn't sexual congress is a sublimation, or, you know, substitute for that final aim. Well, that is simply a sexual reinterpretation of the whole ultimate aim, namely to know of our identity with that which is our full being. Here again, it is the gods who cut the two apart. We have in both of these cases the God-man duality. But in the Jewish case, the virtue is attributed to God. And whenever man does something against him, we come in on God's side. But when, just read Aristophanes' thing. We make a clown of the gods. They're on man's side. And the gods are afraid of man. And perhaps they are. Now with that single myth. We have one tradition that has been threefold inflected in terms of three different meaning systems and value systems. The myths speak of the same mystery. The meaning attributed to it differs in the different cases. I think there's a pretty good example of what I was suggesting yesterday, namely that myth, like being itself, is without ultimate meaning. Life has no meaning. Meaning is a concept system, a category system, and the mystery lies beyond that. So now let me go on from this. The imagery of paradise, the recovered garden, the recovered experience of eternal bliss. You remember shortly after Eve was born, that next day occurred, and Adam looked over and said, "What's this going on? Here she's talking to the serpent." That, as we'll learn a little later, was her earlier consort. She's found her old boyfriend. And Adam comes over and says, "What's this?" And she says, he says, it tastes good. It's good for us. So he eats the fruit. Then shortly later, God, who walks in the cool of the day in that same garden, sees this little pear and he says, "What's going on here? You've got leaves on." And they say, "Well, something has really happened." And God next says, "Lest they should eat the fruit of the second tree, the tree of immortal life. Now that they know of duality, good and evil, let us put them out of the garden." What they became aware of in eating the fruit was duality. Just as the Sanskrit self who said ahang became aware of duality, and they were there lost in fear and desire. They had cut themselves off from the divine innocence in becoming aware of duality. But then, aware of this, if they had eaten the branch of the tree that held the fruit of immortal life, immortality, that they should never die, they would be equivalent to God. And God himself said, lest they become as one of us. You know, Elohim is a plural. There's a kind of rather obscure concept for us there. The God who is one and all at the same time says, lest they become as one of us, let's put them out of the garden. Then he put at the garden gate two cherubim with a flaming sword to keep them from the garden, to keep them in the world of duality. During the war with Japan, there appeared in a New York paper a picture of a Japanese temple guardian. You know those great figures at Nara, looking quite fierce and ferocious with sword and flashing eyes, one with mouth open, the other with the mouth closed. And under it, the newspaper wise men had written, "The Japanese worship gods like this." Well, I knew enough to know that those gods were the guardians at the gate, and that the whole aim of the religion was, and the whole invitation was, walk through the gate, and there you will find the tree of immortal life, with the beautiful Buddha representing the mystery of the tree, teaching the mystery of the tree, with his right hand up saying, "Don't be afraid." And this irreverent thought occurred to me. It is not they who worship a god like that, but we. Because our God says, "Don't walk past the boys at the gate." And what is that tree in the garden? It is exactly the tree under which the Buddha sits. And when you look on your Sumerian seals, you'll see that tree. It is always a palm with two fruits. One, the knowledge of good and evil and duality, and the other, of immortality. Now, in the medieval Christian tradition, the cross is called Holy Rood. It is identified with that second tree in the garden. allegorically, Christ is the fruit of that tree. In the communion meal where we eat Christ, we are eating the fruit of eternal life and eating exactly the fruit of that tree and are experiencing eternal life. And Christ is celebrated in the Middle Ages in a kind of European way as the hero who broke past the gate. And there are hymns saying, "Praise to thee who broke past the gate and opened again the golden way to the tree of paradise." So, Christ on the cross, Buddha on the tree are equivalent figures. These are the same myth. The moment represented in the crucifixion, where the world of matter, which is always symbolized by the cross, to which spirit is linked, pinned in the crucifixion, this tree is exactly the tree under which the Buddha sat. And the moment of the crucifixion is symbolized in that form of the Buddha where he is seated with one hand touching the earth. That's known as the earth-touching posture. I'll have something to say about it later. It is at that moment that he transcended the temptation of the deity known as Love, Death, Kama, Mara, who came to tempt him at the tree. Those same two emotions which had filled Ahang, filled the being that said I, namely fear and lust, desire, were transcended by the Buddha under that tree. The God who is the God of the world, namely the one who said I, comes to him in the form of a tempter. And the tempter presents to him his three beautiful daughters. These are the temptations to lust. Their names are desire, fulfillment, and regrets. If the Buddha had thought I, he would have experienced they. But there was no I there. There was only identity, so there was no desire. He was in what is known as the immovable spot. Next, kama, lust, becomes mara, death. And he throws at the Buddha his army. And the Buddha was absolutely not there. He was that one who was no person anymore. So that the weapons thrown at him when they entered this sphere of non-entity became transmuted into lotus blossoms, and he was, as it were, worshipped. Since neither desire nor fear could move him, the tempter assumed the form of dharma, duty, virtue, and like a sociologist said, "Young man, what are you doing sitting under this tree here? You are a prince, after all. The world is in trouble. Get in there, help your neighbors," and so forth. Now, what do you do when some pompous ass like that comes along? He was riding on an elephant, the whole damn thing. The Buddha simply touched the earth with his hand. Society is second. Nature is first. You're a human being before you're a social being. And in the depth of nature is the mystery that I've been talking about. And that mystery's voice came pouring forth out of the earth. The goddess Earth herself, with a voice of thunder, said, "This is that one who through many lifetimes has so given of himself that there's nobody here." And with that, the elephant on which Lord Dharma rode bowed in worship. The army was dispersed, and that night the Buddha achieved illumination. That is the crucifixion. He crucified in himself all those passions and interests and relationship systems that bind us to the world. This doesn't mean that ultimately he was gone, because he came back and taught for 50 years. Now, who are the guardians at the gate? And what is that gate? In the Christian tradition, we speak of sin and atonement. Adam and Eve offended a pedagogue, their father. They criticized. They stepped away from him. And the only way man could be brought back into proper relationship was by atonement. You have a kind of penal system here of fault and adjustment. This is one way of saying the same thing that is said in the Oriental interpretation of that garden. Look again at the cherubim at the gate. Not the gate of paradise in the Bible, but the gate of Nara. One of them, as I said, is standing with mouth open. The other with mouth closed. These symbolize desire, aggression, fear. These symbolize those passions of fear and desire which keep us out of the gate. It is by transcending, walking between these, leaving ourselves outside, I is massacred at the gate, that we come to the illumination of the center of the garden. What is called Maya, the veil of illusion that obscures us from the truth of our own being, which is no being, is exactly a function of fears and desires. Freud tells us this, exactly the same thing, except that he doesn't push through all the way to the Buddha illumination. All he does is get you back to society again so that you can work the Standard Oil pump or whatever job you have. He feels that what we are alienated from is society. In this system that I'm talking about, what you're alienated from is simply the knowledge of yourself as that from which nothing can be alienated. So here I've given two myths now, shared by two traditions. The myth of the one that became two, whether as Ahang or as Adam, who became Eve, or as the Greek, and three orders of paradise. The Oriental one, where it is simply the recognition of your own identity with that which cannot be identified, or the biblical one of exile, or the later Christian one of exile and return through the Savior, with whom one is, in a sense, to feel identified, but cannot dare to feel actually identical. Now let me just speak very briefly of this alienation problem, which is our own today. When you think of the ARX system, A is related to X. We are related to the divine through our society. I call the first system that I spoke of, the Oriental one, that of mythic identification, where you are to learn through myth to identify yourself with the ultimate being. I would call the second mythic dissociation. The divine is dissociated from nature. Nature, in that sense, is not divine. When you turn inward in meditation, you do not come in touch with the ultimate dimension of divinity. You come in touch with a human soul, which may or may not be in proper relationship to its God. And to get into relationship to its God, it has to relate itself properly to God's society. So you are dissociated, you are alienated from the experience of your own divinity, and you are asked to come into relationship to the ultimate good by way of a society which presents you with certain claims. This I would call social identification. Now what has happened today is that, as a result of our sciences, natural sciences, and historical sciences, the claims of every one of these social traditions have been disqualified. They are not as they pretend to be. And we know it. And so, having had ourselves disqualified as manifestations of the divine by the tradition, that tradition itself is now disqualified as a vehicle of relationship to the divine by science. And so again, we have that experience of alienation. And it is because of this that we are having these strong movements now, all over the place. On one level, simply meditation, this way, that way, or another way. It started with the pouring in of Indian lore in the 19th century, the reaction in European scholarly circles to the translations of the Upanishads when they came in, of the Oriental texts, was absolutely enormous. The fact that we had here a humanism in a certain sense, namely, the highest thing in the universe is illuminated man, which is the only marvel of being that knows that it's a marvel of being. And all the gods are inferior to the illuminated Buddha consciousness. This seemed to unite to our humanistic tradition, as it had been academically received from the Greeks, to unite the religious dimension. And at that same time, the Bible was being disqualified by the archaeological discoveries in the Near East, so that we have one of these scholars after another simply finding, ah, this is it. Think of Schopenhauer. The Upanishads have been the delight of my life, and they will be the consolation of my death. And that was a pretty inferior, third-rate translation of the Upanishads that had given him this great, great inspiration, which was the underlying thought of his whole philosophy. Nietzsche also, one after another. Then, after the Second World War, we have the Japanese, the Zen, the Buddhist thing coming in. Now I notice all over the place the movement of Krishna consciousness, where Western young men actually turn themselves, or try to. I've always felt that the Caucasoid Westerner looks a little bit absurd in the paraphernalia of Oriental, what can we say, social manifestation of your religion, wearing your heart on your sleeve, with their head shaved and the Brahminical tuft, and they not being Brahmins, and the saffron robe and all, chanting Krishna, Krishna, Krishna. The point that always strikes me is, what we are seeking when we turn to the Orient is not to become Orientals. There's no point in making believe you're Japanese, making believe you're Hindu. It is through that that you are to find, through your own nature, your own being, the identity system. And I'm told that the Rashi at Tesshara Springs, one of his first lessons is, you're an American, be an American. Don't be Japanese. There's always a temptation to lose yourself in an act, playing the role of being this, that, or the other thing. All right, if through that act you can bring about the deepening of yourself as you were born, not as you wish you were born, with another complexion and all, it will work. But if it distracts you, it only alienates you the further from the true sense. And so we have these two traditions now, and you can think of it always. Am I working by way of a relationship? Or am I working, with relationship as the final term, or am I working toward identity? And identity was something that is not this limited character here. And then we come to the final point. Having found that identity, what's going to happen? Are you going to slip out? As the Indians say, let the body drop off. First let society drop off, then the body drop off. Or in this quest, are you looking for the root, but you've got also the top of the system, the tree or whatever. You've got to, if you're going to be total, have the two and find a way back. And so it's this total round that I'm going to be talking about later, that the Buddhist and Oriental traditions offer to us. In the Chinese Secret of the Golden Flower, there's that little paragraph that says, first, one seeks the center, and one finds that all is illusion. Next, one recognizes that all is illusion. Next, one moves in the world of illusion in recollection of the center. So those are the East-West comparisons that I propose as basic, and that I'll be returning to in later talks. So let's pause and have our question hour after a brief break.
It seems to me that the Occidentals have a kind of intense recognition and appreciation of personality, and I wonder, is this reflected in the different attitudes towards this separation or non-separation of God and man? And the other question is, how can an Occidental who has this sense of personality go into an Oriental type of, say, attempt at identification? In other words, he is not getting rid of his lust and fear. He's not going through those gates as much as he is going through the gates of dropping his whole personality, which is the thing by which he is initially identified. I'm confused.
Yeah, you haven't confused anything. You've anticipated the talk that I'm hoping to give tomorrow. The actual emphasis on personality is neither Oriental nor Levantine. It's European. And it is particularly recent European. And my identification of the prime symbolism of this is in the legendary of the Arthurian cycle and the Grail. They say the medieval 12th and 13th century cycles are the ones that bring this out, where the peculiarities of the individual are emphasized. But this has been characteristic of the Western thinking, the Greek to North European thinking, from the beginning. When Odysseus goes into the underworld, he recognizes those who are there. When Dante goes through hell, purgatory, and paradise, he recognizes everybody there. When you would go into a Buddhist, a Jain, or a Hindu heaven or hell, you would not recognize anybody there, because they will simply have become, that reincarnating entity, the jiva, will have become a hell being, a heaven being. The Buddhas are all alike. They erase personality. The only way you can tell one from another is by the sign on his chest or the symbology around him. There is no accent on personality. That is the fault in being, in beings. But the celebration of the fault, this is a very lovely question, and there'll be a whole hour in which to talk about that and how to hang on to your faults, how to aggrandize them. Yeah. Yes?
This is very technical. You mentioned a very bad translation of the Upanishad. Could you recommend what you think is the best?
The book that is handiest of the Upanishads is Hume, H-U-M-E, the 13 principal Upanishads of the Vedas. One reason it is the one that I would prefer is that it has an excellent index, so that you can find everything, all of the stanzas and so forth referring to a certain thought. Also, it has an excellent and very cool introduction. You can get all steamed up about the thing in a way that is a little bit distracting. The unfortunate thing is that book has been pushed into the background by some newer things that have come out. Now, Radhakrishnan has a large volume in which he gives the Sanskrit as well as the translation. And if you know Sanskrit at all, it's not a bad thing to have the book with the Sanskrit in it so that you can evaluate the translation. Do you see the Sanskrit words? Well, any translation, even if you've translated from French to English, which is about the easiest there is in the world, you know that you don't get it over. And when you go into these Oriental languages where the concepts just don't coincide at all, you're really in trouble.
Well, there's a marvelous excerpt from Zimmer's, I think, Philosophy of India, one of them with apparently green eyes, and I haven't found that particular wording in
No, of course you wouldn't, because that was my translation.
Great.
Yeah. Thank you. But let me say another word. Nikhilananda, Nikhilananda, has presented, I think, about 4 volumes of Upanishad translations, and he has given also Shankaracharya's commentary and his commentary on Shankara's commentary, so that you can really see something about what these things lead to, particularly in relevance to the classical Vedantic interpretations. Yes?
You had made a point that the word precedes the manifestation of the world. Let there be light, and there was light, in both traditions. And that, what is the significance of that, of the logical precedence?
Well, this is a late thought. This is a mythological thought in itself. I don't mean to say that in actuality words precede things. This is a mythological thesis. The notion is, of course, that in the word you have caught the essence of the thing, and that the perfection of the thing is in the essence, but that in coming into material manifestation, it has come through with faults, with inflections, with hampering aspects, so that you don't get the full thing. But by knowing the word, this is an old magical thing, it's a quite primitive idea, actually. By knowing the word, by knowing the name of a thing, you have it. And it's true. Every artist knows this. I know people that my wife will ask me, the doctor will give me a medicine, and she'll say, what is the medicine? I say, I don't know. Or she say, don't you ask him what it is? I said, no, it doesn't matter to me. But she had the feeling that by knowing the name, she would have the jump on that medicine a little bit. Do you know what I mean? Do you know? It's nice to know. Also, you go to the doctor and there's something wrong with you, and he tells you what it is, something you never heard of before. You feel comforted. The naming, that the mind should be brought in relationship to the thing is a very comforting thing, and we think that that is somehow it. A tree. Okay, that's a tree. This is an animal. Where is it? There are lots of kinds of trees, but somehow associated with the concept tree is the essence of all trees. And so again, the word suggests the essence. And there is this primitive and then later mystical idea that in the word is the essence. Now in both the Sanskrit and the Hebrew traditions, there is some notion of vibrations, that words have certain vibration values, and that it is somehow in the sound of the word that the essence exists. This is called the seed sound in the Sanskrit. When you pronounce om, and I'll be talking about om this afternoon, it's got to be done in a certain way, otherwise it's not working. And I notice also that in real orthodox rabbinical recitation of passages from the Torah, there are certain motions and inflections of the voice associated with it. This you get in the Sanskrit as well. So we would have to imagine Yahweh creating the world with a certain formal ritual attitude and intonation of the words in a certain way, and the bringing about then of the universe. In India, if you're going to be an artist and represent a deity, you must meditate on the deity and pronounce in your mind the seed syllable of that deity's being, and then he will manifest himself to you in your vision, and then you copy the vision.
Well, I got two things really. One, I was noticing in the Sanskrit legend versus the Garden of Eden legend, the creation were in opposite order. The Sanskrit one, it starts with man and works down through cattle and so on down to ants. And in the Garden of Eden one, I know it starts out with the simpler forms and man is the last thing. That's one observation. The other one was in the Sanskrit one, you said that. After the being created or whatever, the first idea was fear of an enemy. But I would think that before that, there would have to be some kind of a sense of satisfaction that being was good, that awareness was good. This was a satisfying thing that you wanted to hold on to before you start worrying that anything might come along and change it.
Yeah, well, that's very. I think that latter is a very keen observation. And of course, it's implied that he thought the being was good, otherwise he wouldn't want to defend it.
Well, I mean, that's not an automatic thing. I don't see that it's so automatic. I think it's forced some attention.
Mm-hmm. You think that you would probably want to defend something that you didn't think was good?
Well, there would be some satisfaction or value. This brings in the whole idea of the value of life. Is something that is alive worth preserving, or should do you have a right to put it out of existence?
Oh, I see. Well, you moved into another sphere. You moved into a sphere of moral evaluations. And let me just say that, and I should have said it earlier, ultimately the dominant characteristic of our Western religious system, since it has nothing to do with identity but only with relationships, you're speaking about a relationship to values here, we have essentially an ethical emphasis in our religions. And when a Western person goes to the Orient and sees how little there is of ethical concern in the religions, as we understand ethics, it's quite surprising. The Oriental religions have an emphasis on the metaphysical dimension. And to experience this, you may violate all the ethical rules. Ethics is secondary there. In our world, it is primary. And with ethics, we can add now aesthetics and logic. All these things are for us very important. And you've presented a very nice logical point. And all I can say is that in that particular text, which I know pretty well, it does not say, after he had said, I am, he was satisfied with that. It says, after he had said, I am, he was filled with fear that that which
that
was.
Anymore, that he wouldn't be anymore. That knowing that you are, or my life is a value, if I think my life is of satisfaction or should continue to exist, I'll act differently than if I thought it was of no importance,
yes,
whether it existed or not.
That's right. If you thought it was worth existing, you would try to preserve it, and you'd be, yeah, fearful that it might be eradicated.
Well,
and if you had no interest in it, then you wouldn't care.
No,
so my point was that in saying he was in fear, the implication is that he thought it was okay to be that way. He liked being. Now, with respect to the first remark, let me remind you that there are two creation stories in the book of Genesis, one in chapter 1 and the other in chapter 2. And they are quite different stories. That in chapter 1 is of the late priestly tradition, which is post-Ezra. It belongs to about the Hellenistic period, something like the 3rd or 2nd centuries B.C. That of the second chapter is of the earlier Yavist tradition and dates from about the 9th century B.C. In the first, God creates the world with this let there be technique. And he starts with more elemental and moves, well, first he says light before there was a sun.
Light formal.
Yeah, and then later on comes the sun and all that sort of thing, and then the birds and beasts and all that, and up then man man and woman,
yeah,
are last. He creates them in his image, male and female created he them. Then you come to chapter 2, and you have God building a garden, then wanting a gardener, and creating Adam to be the gardener, and then bringing the animals. So that actually that is the story which I was connecting with the Indian story, and with a loose throw around, it fits pretty closely, the Indian. And the interesting thing is that these two texts are about the same date. The Brihadaranyaka Upanishad is of about the date of the this text in the chapter 2.
Wouldn't that be part of the substance?
Yes, and in India, the breath, prana, is exactly the substance.
The second story is the oldest story? The
one, it's the oldest story. And it's, of course, the more mythological in its character. The other is rather more systematic. There's something peculiar about the other one, though, that it should have been invented in that very, at that very late date. The Greeks had already measured the dimensions of the earth and knew.
It seems that like in the first story where you have this God brooding over the
yes,
waters, that's the first story, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, exactly.
That seems to me to be more archaic, maybe more of a whole image of God rather than immediately having this Father creating the garden. It seems to be more in the Jewish tradition, Christian tradition, than the other one would be.
Well, I think one can say that the other is certainly an older story and points back to an earlier tradition. and that the first chapter, being the priestly chapter, the later date, would, as you say, be closer to our own tradition, or have I misinterpreted?
No, I meant the second story with the garden.
Oh.
Seems in terms of this father creating and judging and moving along, whereas the earlier story just has this very primeval, it reminds me of a lot of other mythologies, remember, this very primeval state where you just have this god brooding over the tempestuous sea. It's a fabulous image.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me to be much more archaic an image than God just creating a garden.
Yes, like well, I really don't think it is more archaic, because if you read Ovid's Metamorphoses, which was written at about the same date as these texts, you see that everything in the beginning was chaos, which is the cosmic sea, where opposites are not distinguished from each other. There's a confusion of things. And then Deus, a deity, brought forth order out of cosmos, exactly the same image from exactly the same date. And since this priestly text was written in the Hellenistic world, in the world of that Hellenistic mixture of things, where people were systematizing and all, what one finds very often is surprises of this kind. What one would think would be the more primitive turns out to be the later one, and then one must look at it again, and you'll see that it is a more systematized creation than the earlier, simpler one. But that garden that God built, and then the creation of men to a man to take care of the garden, exactly corresponds to the Sumerian, the older Sumerian idea of the gods who got sick and tired of tilling the fields to feed themselves, and so created man to be the tiller of the fields. And there you have the idea of a creation of man as a servant, as a slave, man as a slave or servant of the gods, which comes right down through all of our West Occidental traditions as they've been derived from the Levant. Greeks never had the idea of man as a slave of the gods. Men and the gods were equally children of Gaia, of Mother Earth. And it was just that the gods were your big brother, and look out. Any younger brother who respects his big brother is rather exceptional, I think, and the Greeks were not of that disposition. Whereas when the god is the creator of servants, and the servant owes his whole existence to the god, there you get a totally different. This is why Nietzsche called this tradition the tradition of slave morality. The morality of obedience to a superior being. And the Greek is the noble one, that even if you're gonna, I think the little brother who hits his big brother is a little hero. Yeah?
Curious, perhaps a very useful point, but you were speaking last night of the planet Venus, when the king and his court were trying to imitate the cosmological order that was discovered. And the queen was represented by the planet Venus, and she was symbolized by a hand. And she would follow him and resurrect him, you said, in the cosmological, and then the microcosm, the macrocosm spheres. Is there any relation between that gesture of the hand and the gesture of Buddha?
Yes.
The hand which you,
it's the rescuing. Do not be afraid, there is nothing to fear. You have gone through death, but look, there is eternal life. And it's her act that brings the implication of that hand into fulfillment.
Yes.
This hand is a marvelous, strange thing. The Bodhisattva hand, in many cases, has an eye in it. It is with the eye, the opening of the eye, that one perceives the sufferings of the world and is filled with compassion, karuna, for the world. And that's the hand of compassionate consolation. Now there's a very interesting artifact that was unearthed in one of the Southeast American mounds, the American Indian mounds, from the Hopewellian period. This is about 500 AD or something like that. And what it shows are two rattlesnakes in a circle knotted, and in the middle a hand with the eye. The symbolism of the Buddha is almost exactly the symbolism of Shiva. Shiva is the lord of the phallus, and the Buddha is not. When you have a cross, the cross is right in the middle, as anyone who's ever studied figure drawing will tell you, it crosses right at the level of the genitals. That's the midpoint of the human body. And the normal human body, some have shorter legs, but the norm is right there. And when you move the cross up to the head, you have shifted the center of emphasis from the genitals to the head. And the principal Hebrew rite is, of course, circumcision, which is a genital emphasis. With the circumcision, the nature organ is dedicated to the social group. It is society that has taken possession of your nature, and you are no longer a nature man, you are of Israel. Whereas in the Christian tradition, there is not a nature emphasis. Christianity is what is called a creedal religion, as Buddhism is. One is born a Jew, one becomes a Christian. One is born a Hindu, one becomes a Buddhist. These two latter are world religions because they are religions of belief, not of who your mother was. The Hebrew tradition, a Jew is in considerable confusion in the contemporary world because the general religious atmosphere is a religious is an atmosphere of belief, what you believe, whereas the Jewish emphasis is on your birth. And in Israel itself, there are legal debates now as to who is eligible for citizenship. A Jew who is no longer a believer in Judaism, a believer in Judaism who is no Jew. What are you going to do here? This is complicated. There are two totally different religious concepts that have come into collision in the context of this religion. Similarly, in Hinduism, when people speak of being converted to being a Hindu, you can't be converted to being Hindu. You can be converted to being a sort of second-class Hindu. And in the old Jewish missionizing days of the 4th and 5th centuries, converts could not say, my God. They could say, your God. They'd have to wait for their children to be Jews in the full sense. Now, in the Buddhist tradition, you do not have the phallic emphasis of Shivaism until much later in Tantric tradition, or something else again. When you see the Buddha, the emphasis is on the head. The Buddha's birth, a virgin birth. He is born from his mother's side. This means that the birth is not to be physical, but spiritual. Come into a new mode of spiritual life. That's the sense of the virgin birth. Now, the contemporary Orthodox fooling around on is it physically possible and all this, which the church is all involved in, this is perfectly ridiculous. This says that what it does is cut off your understanding of the sense of the symbol. I found a perfectly delicious little Chinese picture of the birth of the Buddha in the Indian imagery when it appears. He's being born from his mother's side. The little child's coming out here. Whereas in the Chinese and Japanese don't make a big thing of the physical body. The Hindus, of course, glory in it, all these voluptuous forms. The Japanese always have kimonos on. So, he's coming right out of his mother's sleeve.
There are so many crosses that you see in Japanese temples that are,
those are the squared cross.
These are the squared cross. And do they have any connection backwards? And if so, when they put the little, ends on them, they look like a swastika backwards. Do you know what connection that has?
Well, they are swastikas. The cross is the earth, is the world of matter. The swastika, which suggests movement, is the sunwise turn, or in reverse, the counter-sunwise turn. And what it refers to is the circumambulation of the mystical center of the temple. All temples are built in the form, really, of the prime image structuring of a temple is in the form of a cross. Sanctuary in the center, the four gates. This is symbolic of the form of the universe, which is a circle with four gates, north, south, east, and west, sunrise, sunset, north, south. And in the center is the mystery of the fifth, the point, the hub, where opposites come together. Where the Buddha sat was right there. That's where the tree of the garden is. And here is where opposites come together and are dissolved, where movement and stillness are identified. And that's the cross, and then the swinging around the cross shows the movement around the center.
The
Lao Tzu uses this image in the Tao Te Ching of the hub.
Robert Graves talks about the swastika. is a fire wheel, which would also give another perspective for that.
Well, it's a fire wheel, and the sun is a fire wheel, and the sun goes on the revolution. The question of the origin of the swastika is a moot question. It is not pinned down yet, and there are guesses. A prime guess, and a very good one, is that it began in late Paleolithic times with representations of the stork. The stork is a killer of serpents. And now we come to a whole body of symbols that I propose to speak about later. This one of fire and water, the eagle, stork, the serpent, the lion, the bull, the sun, and the moon. These all belong in polar consistency to the same symbolic context. The swastika may belong there. The earliest swastika of which we have any knowledge was found in the Ukraine in a late Paleolithic Magdalenian site, and it is on the lower wings of what seems to be a kind of a bird. We don't know what kind of bird it was, but this big swastika is described on the lower wings, an extremely elaborate one. That's a kind of unique occurrence of the swastika. The historic occurrence comes with the about late 5th and early 4th millenniums BC in the ceramic art known as the Samara style of Iran. It appears in Susa and all those places. And there the swastika comes in the center of these ceramic designs. This is the period when the beautiful painted pottery ware in geometric organization appears first. And this goes then to China and India and all over the world and to the Americas.